Ridiculous to think of flying at more than 100 miles an hour. The human body would not stand the strain, they said. Ridiculous to think of going into space. Monkeys have already. This ridiculous idea of mine. I have seen it working. The noises from without penetrated my room, bringing me back to the present. Noises. Shunting trains, a screaming fire engine whizzed by, and loud talking people hasten into the bright lights of a local place of entertainment. Later, I tell myself, when this terrible clamor stops, I will use the crystal, and will tell them that I will do as they ask. A growing warm feeling inside tells me that they already know, and are glad. So, here as it is directed, the truth, the Rampa story. Chapter 2. Tibet, at the turn of the century, was beset by many problems. Britain was making a great uproar, shouting to all the world that Tibet was too friendly with Russia, to the detriment of British imperialism. The Tsar of all the Russias was shrieking in the vast halls of his palace in Moscow, complaining vociferously that Tibet was becoming too friendly with Britain. The royal court of China resounded with fevered accusations that Tibet was being too friendly with Britain and with Russia, and was most certainly not friendly enough with China. Lhasa swarmed with spies of various nations, poorly disguised as mendicant monks or pilgrims, or missionaries, or anything which seemed to offer a plausible excuse for being in Tibet at all. Sundry gentlemen of assorted races met deviously under the dubious cover of darkness to see how they could profit by the troubled international situation. The great 13th, the 13th Dalai Lama incarnation and a great statesman in his own right, kept his temper and the peace, and steered Tibet clear of embroilment. Polite messages of undying friendship, and insincere offers of protection crossed the sacred Himalayas from the heads of the leading nations of the world. Into such an atmosphere of trouble and unrest I was born. As Grandmother Rampa so truly said, I was born to trouble and have been in trouble ever since, and hardly any of it of my own making. The seers and soothsayers were loud in their praise of the boy's inborn gifts of clairvoyance and telepathy. An exalted ego, said one. Destined to leave his name in history, said another. A great light to our cause, said a third. And I, at that early age, raised up my voice in hearty protest at being so foolish, as to be born once again. Relatives, as soon as I was able to understand their speech, took every opportunity to remind me of the noise I made. They told me with glee that mine was the most raucous, the most unmusical voice that it had been their misfortune to hear. Father was one of the leading men of Tibet. A noble man of high degree, he had considerable influence in the affairs of our country. Mother too, through her side of the family, exercised much authority in matters of policy. Now, looking back over the years, I am inclined to think that they were almost as important as Mother thought, and that was of no mean order. My early days were spent at our home near the Patala, just across the Kalingchu, or Happy River. Happy because it gave life to Lhasa as it ran chuckling over many brooks, and meandered in rivulet form through the city. Our home was well wooded, well staffed with servants, and my parents lived in princely splendor. I was subjected to much discipline, much hardship. Father had become greatly soured during the Chinese invasion in the first decade of the century, and he appeared to have taken an irrational dislike to me. Mother, like so many society women throughout the world, had no time for children, looking upon them as things to be got rid of as speedily as possible, and then parked on some hired attendant. Brother Palger did not stay with us long. Before his 7th birthday he left for the heavenly fields and peace. I was 4 years of age then, and father's dislike for me seemed to increase from that time. Sister Yasudhara was 6 at the time of the passing of our brother, and we both bemoaned, not the loss of our brother, but the increased discipline which started at his passing. Now my family are all dead, killed by the Chinese communists. My sister was killed for resisting the advances of the invaders. My parents for being landowners. The home from whence I gazed wide-eyed over the beautiful parkland has been made into dormitories for slave workers. In one wing of the house are women workers, and in the right wing are men. All are married, and if husband and wife behave and do their quota of work, they can see each other once a week for half an hour, after which they are medically examined. 28 But in the far-off days of my childhood these things were in the future, something which was known would happen, but which, like death at the end of one's life, did not obtrude too much. The astrologers had indeed foretold these happenings, but we went about our daily life blissfully oblivious of the future. Just before I was 7 years of age, at the age when my brother left this life, there was a huge ceremonial party at which the state astrologers consulted their charts and determined what my future was going to be. Everyone who was anything was there. Many came uninvited by bribing servants to let them in. The crush was so thick that there was hardly room to move in our ample grounds. The priest fumbled and bumbled, as priests will, and put on an impressive show, before announcing the outstanding points of my career. In fairness, I must state that they were absolutely right in everything unfortunate which they said. Then they told my parents that I must enter the Chakpuri Lamasery, to be trained as a medical monk. My gloom was quite intense, because I had a feeling that it would lead to trouble. No one listened to me, though, and I was shortly undergoing the ordeal of sitting outside the Lamasery gate for 3 days and nights just to see if I had the endurance necessary to become a medical monk. That I passed the test was more a tribute to my fear of father than of my physical stamina. Entry to the Chakpuri was the easiest stage. Our days were long. It was hard indeed to have a day which started at midnight, and which required us to attend services at intervals throughout the night as well as throughout the day. We were taught the ordinary academic stuff, our religious duties, matters of the metaphysical world, and medical lore, for we were to become medical monks. Our Eastern cures were such that Western medical thought still cannot understand them. Yet, Western pharmaceutical firms are trying hard to synthesize the potent ingredients which are in the herbs we used. Then, the age-old Eastern remedy, now artificially and will be hailed as an example of Western achievement. Such is progress. When I was 8 years of age, I had an operation which opened my third eye, that special organ of clairvoyance which is morbid in most people, because they deny its existence. With this eye seeing, I was able to distinguish the human aura and so divine the intention of those around me. It was, and is, most entertaining to listen to the empty words of those who pretended friendship for self-gain, yet truly had black murder in their hearts. The aura can tell the whole medical history of a person by determining what is missing from the aura, and replacing the deficiencies by special radiations. People can be cured of illness. Because I had stronger than usual powers of clairvoyance, I was very frequently called upon by the Inmost One, the great 13th incarnation of the Dalai Lama, to look at the aura of those who visited him in friendship. My beloved guide, the Lama Menjur Dondup, a very capable clairvoyant, trained me well. He also taught me the greatest secrets of astral traveling, which now to me is easier than walking. Almost anyone, no matter what they call their religion, believes in the existence of a soul or other body. Actually, there are several bodies or sheaths, but the exact number does not concern us here. We believe, rather we know, that it is possible to lay aside the ordinary physical body, the one that supports the clothes, and travel anywhere, even beyond the earth, in the astral form. Everyone does astral traveling, even the ones who think it is all nonsense. It is as natural as breathing. Most people do it when they are asleep, and so, unless they are trained, they know nothing about it. How many people, in the morning, exclaim, "Oh, I had such a wonderful dream last night, I seemed to be with so and so. We were very happy together, and she said she was writing." Of course, it is all very vague now. And then, usually in a very few days, a letter does arrive. The explanation is that one of the persons traveled astrally to the other, and because they were not trained, it became a dream. Almost anyone can astral travel. How many authenticated cases there are of dying persons visiting a loved one in a dream, in order to say goodbye. Again, it is astral traveling. The dying person, with the bonds of the world loosened, easily visits a friend in passing. The trained person can lie down and relax and then ease off the ties that chain the ego, or companion body, or soul, call it what you will. It is the same thing, then, when the only connection between is the silver cord, the second body can drift off, like a captive balloon at the end of its line. Wherever you can think of, there you can go. Fully conscious, fully alert, when you are trained. The dream state is when a person astral travels without knowing it, and brings back a confused, jumbled impression. Unless one is trained, there are a multitude of impressions constantly being received by the silver cord which confuses the dreamer more and more. In the astral you can go anywhere, even beyond the confines of the earth, for the astral body does not breathe, nor does it eat. All its wants are supplied by the silver cord which, during life, constantly connects it to the physical body. The silver cord is mentioned in the Christian Bible, lest the silver cord be severed, and the golden bowl be shattered. The golden bowl is the halo or nimbus around the head of a spiritually evolved person. Those not spiritually evolved have a halo of a very different color. Artists of old painted a golden halo around the pictures of saints, because the artists actually saw the halo, otherwise he would not have painted it. The halo is merely a very small part of the human aura, but is more easily seen because it is usually much brighter. If scientists would investigate astral travel and auras, instead of meddling with fizzling rockets which so often fail to go into orbit, they would have the complete key to space travel. By astral projection they could visit another world, and so determine the type of ship needed to make the journey in the physical, for astral travel has one great drawback: one cannot take any material object, nor can one return with any material object. One can only bring back knowledge. So, the scientists will need a ship in order to bring back live specimens and photographs with which to convince an incredulous world, for people cannot believe a thing exists unless they can tear it to pieces in order to prove that it might be possible after all. I am particularly reminded of a journey into space which I took. This is absolutely true, and those who are evolved will know it as such. It does not matter about the others, they will learn when they reach a greater stage of spiritual maturity. This is an experience which happened some years ago when I was in Tibet studying at the Chakpori Lamasery. Although it happened many years ago, the memory of it is as fresh in my mind as if it happened but yesterday. My guide, the Lama Menger Dondup, and a fellow Lama, actually a close friend of mine named Jigme, and I, were upon the roof of the Chakpori, on Iron Mountain, in Lhasa, Tibet. It was a cold night indeed, some 40 degrees below zero. As we stood upon the exposed roof the shrieking wind pressed our robes tightly against our shivering bodies. At the sight of us away from the wind our robes streamed out like prayer flags, leaving us chilled to the marrow, threatening to pull us over the precipitous mountainside. As we looked about us, leaning heavily against the wind to maintain our balance, we saw the dim lights of Lhasa City in the distance, while off to our right the lights of the Patala added to the mystical air of the scene. All the windows seemed to be adorned with gleaming butter lamps, which even though protected by the mighty walls, wavered and danced at the bidding of the wind. In the faint starlight the golden roofs of the Patala were reflecting and glinting as if the moon itself had descended, and played among the pinnacles and tombs atop the glorious building. But we shivered in the bitter cold, shivered, and wished that we were warm in the incense laden air of the temple beneath us. We were on the roof for a special purpose, as the Lama Menger Dondup enigmatically put it. Now he stood between us, seemingly as firm as the mountain itself, as he pointed upwards at a far distant star, a red-looking world, and said, "My brothers, this is the star Joro, an old planet, one of the oldest in this particular system. Now it is approaching the end of its long lifetime." He turned to us with his back to the biting wind, and said, "You have studied much in astral traveling. Now, together we will travel in the astral to that planet. We will leave our bodies here upon this wind-swept roof, and we will move up beyond the atmosphere, beyond even time." So saying he led the way across the roof to where there was some slight shelter afforded by a projecting cupola of the roof. He lay down, and bade us to lie beside him. We wrapped our robes tightly around us and each held the hand of the other. Above us was the deep purple vault of the heavens, speckled with faint pinpricks of light, colored light, because all planets have different lights when seen in the clear night air of Tibet. Around us was the shrieking wind, but our training had always been severe, and we thought not of remaining on that roof. We knew that this was not to be an ordinary journey into the astral, for we did not often leave our bodies thus exposed to inclement weather. When a body is uncomfortable the ego can travel further and faster, and remember in greater detail. Only for small transworld journeys does one relax and make the body comfortable. My guide said, "Now let us clasp our hands together, and let us project ourselves together beyond this earth. Keep with me, and we will journey far and have unusual experiences this night." We lay back and breathed in the accepted pattern for astral traveling release. I was conscious of the wind screaming through the cords of the prayer flags which fluttered madly above us. Then, all of a sudden, there was a jerk and I felt no more the biting fingers of the chill wind. I found myself floating, as if in a different time, above my body, and all was peaceful. The Lama Menjur Dondup was already standing erect in his astral form, and then, as I looked down, I saw my friend Jigmalso leaving his body. He and I stood and made a link, to join us to our guide the Lama Menjur Dondup. This link, called ectoplasm, is manufactured from the astral body by thought. It is the material from which mediums produce spirit manifestations. The bond completed, we soared upwards up into the night sky. I, ever inquisitive, looked down beneath us. Streaming beneath us were our silver cords, those endless cords which join the physical and the astral bodies during life. We flew on and on, upwards. The earth receded. We could see the corona of the sun peering across the far ridge of the earth and what must have been the Western world into which we had so extensively traveled in the astral. Higher we went, and then we could see the outlines of the oceans and continents in the sunlit part of the world. From our height the world now looked like a crescent moon, but with the aurora borealis, or northern lights, flashing across the poles. We moved on and on, faster and faster, until we outstripped the speed of light, for we were disembodied spirits, soaring ever onwards, approaching almost the speed of thought. As I looked ahead of me, I saw a planet, huge and menacing in red, straight in front of me. We were falling towards it at a speed impossible to calculate. Although I had had much experience of astral traveling, I felt pangs of alarm. The astral form of the Lama Menjur Dondup chuckled telepathically and said, "Oh Lobsang, if we were to hit that planet it would not hurt them or us. We should go straight through it, there would be no bar." At last we found ourselves floating above a red, desolate world, red rocks, red sand in a tideless red sea. As we sank down towards the surface of this world we saw strange creatures like huge crabs moving lethargically along the water's edge. We stood upon that red rock shore and looked upon the water, tideless, deadly, with red scum upon it, stinking scum. As we watched, the turbid surface rippled unwillingly, and rippled again, and a strange unearthly creature emerged, a creature also red, heavily armored, and with remarkable joints. It groaned as if tired and dispirited, and reaching the red sand, it flopped down by the side of the tideless sea. Above our heads a red sun glowed dully, casting fearful, blood-red shadows, harsh and garish. About us there was no movement, no sign of life other than the strange shelled creatures which lay half-dead on the ground. Even though I was in the astral body I shivered in apprehension as I gazed about me. A red sea upon which floated red scum, red rocks, red dying embers of a fire which was about to flicker into nothingness. The Lama Menjur Dondup said, "This is a dying world. There is no longer rotation here. This world floats derelict in the sea of space, a satellite to a dying sun, which is soon to collapse, and thus to become a dwarf star without life, without light, a dwarf star which eventually will collide with another star, and from those another world shall be born. I have brought you here, because yet in this world there is life of a high order, a life which is here for research and investigation of phenomena of this sort. Look about you." He turned and pointed with his right hand to the far distance, and we saw three immense towers reaching up into the red sky, and on the very top of those towers three gleaming crystal balls glowed and pulsated with clear, yellow light, as if they were alive. As we stood there wondering, one of the lights changed, one of the spheres turned a vivid electric blue. The Lama Menjur Dondup said, "Come, they are bidding us welcome. Let us descend into the ground to where they are living in an underground chamber." Together we moved toward the base of that tower, and then, as we stood beneath the framework we saw there was an entrance heavily secured with some strange metal which glimmered and stood out like a scar upon that red and barren land. We moved through it, for metal, or rocks, or anything is no bar to those in the astral. We moved through and traversed long red corridors of dead rock until at last we stood in a very large hall, a hall surrounded by charts and maps, and strange machines and instruments. In the center there was a long table at which sat nine very aged men, all unlike each other. One was tall and thin, and with a pointed head, a conical head. Yet another was short and very solid looking. Each of these men was different. It was clear to us that each man was of a different planet, of a different race. Human. Well, perhaps humanoid would be a better word with which to describe them. They were all human, but some were more human than others. We became aware that all nine were looking fixedly in our direction. Said one telepathically, "We have visitors from afar. We saw you land upon this, our research station, and we bid you welcome." "Respected fathers," said the Lama Minjur Dandup, "I have brought to you two who have just entered upon the state of Lamahood, and who are earnest students in search of knowledge." "They are indeed welcome," said the tall man, who was apparently the leader of the group. "We will do anything to help as we have helped you with others previously." This was indeed news to me, because I had no idea that my guide did such extensive astral traveling through celestial places. The shorter man was looking at me and smiled. He said in the universal language of telepathy, "I see, young man, that you are greatly intrigued by the difference in our appearances." "Respected father," I replied, somewhat overawed by the ease with which he had divined my thoughts, thoughts which I had tried hard to conceal. "That is indeed a fact. I marvel at the disparity of sizes and shapes between you, and it occurred to me that you could not all be men of Earth." "You have perceived correctly," said the short man. "We are all human, but due to environment we have altered our shapes and our stature somewhat. But can you not see the same thing on your own planet, where upon the land of Tibet there are some monks whom you employ as guards who are 7 feet tall? Yet upon another country of that world, you have people who are but half that stature, and you call them pygmies. They are both human. They are both able to reproduce each with the other, notwithstanding any difference in size, for we are all humans of carbon molecules. Here in this particular universe everything depends upon the basic molecules of carbon and hydrogen, for these two are the bricks compassing the structure of your universe. We who have traveled in other universes far beyond this particular branch of our nebulae know that other universes use different bricks. Some use silicon, some use gypsum, some use other things, but they are different from people of this universe, and we find to our sorrow that our thoughts are not always in affinity with them. The Lama Minjur Dandup said, "I have brought these two young lamas here so that they can see the stages of death and decay in a planet which has exhausted its atmosphere, and in which the oxygen of that atmosphere has combined with metals to burn them and to reduce everything to an impalpable dust." "That is so," said the tall man. "We would like to point out to these young men that everything that is born must die. Everything lives for its allotted span, and that allotted span is a number of units of life. A unit of life in any living creature is a heartbeat of that creature. The life of a planet is 2,700,000,100 heartbeats, after which the planet dies, but from the death of a planet others are born. A human too lives for 2,700,000,100 heartbeats, and so does the lowliest insect. An insect which lives for but 24 hours has, during that time, had 2,700,000,100 heartbeats. A planet, they vary, of course, but one planet may have one heartbeat in 27,000 years, and after that there will be a convulsion upon that world as it shakes itself ready for the next heartbeat. All life, then," he went on, "has the same span, but some creatures live at rates different from those of others. Creatures upon Earth, the elephant, the tortoise, the ant and the dog, they all live for the same number of heartbeats, but all have hearts beating at different speeds, and thus they may appear to live longer or to live less." Jigmund, I found this extremely enthralling, and it explained so much to us that we had perceived upon our native land of Tibet. We had heard in the Patala about the tortoise which lives for so many years, and about the insect which lived for but a summer's evening. Now we could see that their perceptions must have been speeded up to keep pace with their speeding hearts. The short man, who seemed to look upon us with considerable approval, said, "Yes, not only that, but many animals represent different functions of the body. The cow, for instance, as anyone can see, is merely a walking mammary gland. The giraffe is a neck. A dog, well, anyone knows what a dog is always thinking of, sniffing the wind for news as his sight is so poor, and so a dog can be regarded as a nose. Other animals have similar affinities to different parts of one's anatomy. The anteater of South America could be looked upon as a tongue. For some time we talked telepathically, learning many strange things, learning with the speed of thought as one does in the astral. Then at last the Lama Minjur Dandup stood up, and said it was time to leave. Beneath us as we returned the golden roofs of the Patala gleamed in the frosty sunlight. Our bodies were stiff, heavy, and difficult to work with their half-frozen joints. And so, we thought, as we stumbled to our feet, another experience, another journey has ended. What next? A science at which we Tibetans excelled was healing by herbs. Always until now, Tibet has been shut off from foreigners, and our fauna and flora have never been explored by the foreigners. On the high plateaus grow strange plants. Dura and the recently discovered mescaline, for instance, were known in Tibet centuries ago. We could cure many of the afflictions of the Western world, but first the people of the Western world would have to have a little more faith. But most of the Westerners are mad anyway, so why bother? Every year parties of us, those who had done best at their studies, went on herb-gathering expeditions. Plants and pollens, roots, and seeds, were carefully gathered, treated, and stored in yak hide sacks. I loved the work and studied well. Now I find that the herbs I knew so well cannot be obtained here. Eventually I was considered fit to take the ceremony of the little death, which I wrote about in the third eye. By special rituals I was placed in a state of cataleptic death, far beneath the Patala, and I journeyed into the past, along the Akashic record. I journeyed to the lands of the earth, but let me write it as it felt to me then. The corridor in the living rock hundreds of feet beneath the frozen earth was dank, dank and dark with the darkness of the tomb itself. I moved along its length drifting like smoke in the blackness, and with increasing familiarity with that blackness I perceived at first indistinctly the greenish phosphorescence of moldering vegetation clinging to the rock walls. Occasionally where the vegetation was most prolific, and the light the brightest, I could catch a yellow gleam from the gold vein running the length of this rocky tunnel. I drifted along soundlessly without consciousness of time, without thought of anything, except that I must go farther and farther into the interior of the earth, for this was a day which was momentous to me, a day when I was returning from 3 days in the astral state. Time passed and I found myself deeper, deeper in the subterranean chamber in increasing blackness, a blackness which seemed to sound, a blackness which seemed to vibrate. In my imagination I could picture the world above me, the world to which I was now returning. I could visualize the familiar scene now hidden by total darkness. I waited, poised in the air like a cloud of incense smoke in a temple. Gradually, so slowly that it was some time, before I could even perceive it, a sound came down the corridor, the vaguest of sounds, but gradually swelling and increasing in intensity. The sound of chanting, the sound of silver bells, and the muffled shush-shush of leather-bound feet. At last, at long last, an eerie wavering light appeared glistening along the walls of the tunnel. The sound was becoming louder now. I waited poised above a rock slab in the darkness. I waited. Gradually, oh so gradually, so painfully slowly, moving figures crept cautiously down the tunnel towards me. As they came closer I saw that they were yellow-robed monks bearing aloft glaring torches, precious torches from the temple above with rare resin woods and incense sticks bound together giving a fragrant scent to drive away the odors of death and of decay, bright lights to dim and make invisible the evil glow of the rank vegetation. Slowly the priests entered the underground chamber. Two moved to each of the walls near the entrance and fumbled on the rocky ledges. Then one after the other flickering butter lamp sprang into life. Now the chamber was more illuminated and I could look about me once again and see as I had not seen for 3 days. The priests stood around me and saw me not. They stood around a stone tomb resting in the center of the chamber. The chanting increased, and the ringing of the silver bells too. At last, at a signal given by an old man, six monks stopped and panting and grunting lifted the stone lid off the coffin. Inside as I looked down I saw my own body, a body clad in the robes of a priest of the Lama class. The monks were chanting louder now, singing. O spirit of the visiting Lama, wandering the face of the world above, return for this, the third day has come and is about to pass. A first stick of incense is lit to recall the spirit of the visiting Lama. A monk stood forth and lit a stick of sweet-smelling incense, red in color,